Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The heart remains wounded when you look for others to place a bandage. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Ahoy, my dear shitshows. Happy, happy damn new year to ya. And let me just say, good riddance 2024. Don't let the door hit you on the way out, okay? 2024, not my best year, folks. Not my best year at all. Quite a doozy of a year, actually. And you know what? I think that sometimes we actually can downplay just truly how big of an accomplishment it can be to just make it through the year. Like, surviving a challenging year, beginning and ending the year with a damn pulse, like, that isn't just some small feat, okay? It is actually quite impressive. And so I want to publicly acknowledge and give myself the recognition that I deserve for just getting through this year. And I really hope that you were able to extend this same sentiment towards yourself. And so I am making a promise to you and to myself to continue to show up, flaws, failures, and all. Okay? Let's do the damn thing. Let's continue to do the damn thing. And so as we are on the brink of this new year, and as I am still on my little break, my hiatus, I thought that it would be perfect timing for us to dive into, to revisit a topic that really touches on the core of this adult child condition, and that is attachment styles. As I harp on constantly, this is relational trauma that we are dealing with, and a very crucial component of this relational trauma is our attachment wounds and our attachment styles. And this includes not just the relationship that we have with others, this includes the relationship that we have with ourselves. And so I have pulled some of my favorite clips from episodes where we have discussed attachment styles and put together this hard-hitting compilation for you today. So you're going to get to hear from Mr. Fixer Picker, Adam Raskas, from Dr. Morgan Anderson, and from Dr. Sophia Voss. And if you would like to hear these interviews in their entirety, I have included a link to those episodes in the show notes. So let's get on with the damn show. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show, my online support community where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups. And honestly, I can't think of a better way to kick off this new year, guys, than by damning the Join Shit Show and by giving yourself the support that you not only need but deserve on this healing journey. What better way to kick off your year than to join a group of people that will make you feel seen, heard, and understood like never before? This community is fertilizer to this healing work, and you are doing yourself a damn disservice by not being a part of it. So you, yes you, and has been wanting to join for forever, how about we do something about that today? How about we start this new year off on the right foot by damning the join for less than $1 a day? Okay, see the link in the show notes to join. Next, give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, please, please give me a 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all.
So let's talk about attachmentship. Now, okay. I think that most people listening are probably familiar, but let's do a 10,000 foot overview on what the hell we mean by that. And if you want to break down the different types.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's see what we can do with this. So attachment theory, I think, is the framework for how human beings relate to other human beings.
Who came up with it?
So John Bowlby started the research. Mary Ainsworth, Mary Main, a bunch of other people contributed to it and built upon it. And,
what year are we talking here?
Oh, Lordy, I don't know, 60s, 70s. I could have just made that up. We don't know.
7 BC.
Yeah, something like that. So anyway, let's see, big picture. So attachment, when babies are born, they need a caregiver to be there to, I mean, humans are the most dependent little larva animals when we're born. Like we're completely useless when we're born.
I don't like
born.
That word.
Yeah.
Larva. Well, let's not use that again.
Okay. No more of that. But we're these, like, you know, like a baby horse can trot at like 3 hours old.
Wow.
A human baby is trash for like the first 18 years.
Yeah. Right?
Like it's tough to get us up and running. But anyway, we're these little human starter kits. And so if you just left a baby there on the table, it would perish rapidly without the nurturing caregiver. So we need to attach to a parent figure of some sort that can give us nurturing and protection and care and food and shelter, all that stuff. So attachment is our very first essential human need, right? We absolutely need to attach. Okay. Now, in this attachment, we get connection and we get protection. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to simplify things here and make it very,
it's good.
You know, big picture. Connection and protection. When we don't get our need for connection met adequately, so there's sporadic parenting, there's abandonment, there's emotional distance, where there's no connection or there's not consistent connection being met, we develop an anxious attachment style, which is like, oh, I have to chase people down. I have to pretend to be something I'm not. I got to tap dance for my worth. I need to, like, you know, mm-hmm. I can't get my needs met. I need to chase after people to get my needs met, because there's this abandonment of some sort, physical or emotional abandonment, that creates this anxious pattern of relating to other people. And you carry that through the rest of your life, mm-hmm. unfortunately. Now, there's something you can do about it, obviously, but we'll get to that later. If your need for protection is not met, if there's unhealthy closeness, abuse, control, manipulation, if you get a sense that, like, relationships are not safe, you know, when you're a kid, you develop an avoidant attachment style, which doesn't mean that you don't want connection. It's just that you have an experience of relationships not being a safe place. And so, so you have anxious and avoidant are the two main dysfunctional, insecure attachment styles. I'm running towards people, or I'm kind of, you know, pushing people away. It's super generalized, we're talking right now. And then there's also disorganized attachment style, when you have both experiences of unhealthy closeness and unhealthy distance. You know, and you're like, oh, I need relationships. You dive into one and you're like, oh shit, this isn't safe. And you want to sabotage it. Like, it's, you know, hence the name disorganized. It doesn't follow one pattern of, you know, consistent behavior in relationships. And then if you had wonderful parents that were attuned to your emotional needs and took care of you and, you know, gave you
whatever
you
needed.
Yeah, screw you. But then
turn this podcast off, okay?
This isn't for you. But that's they call that secure attachment, right? And that's the holy grail of human relationships.
They say that's 50%. Do you believe that?
I don't believe that.
I don't
either. It's hard for me to believe. Yeah, 50%. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, there's, I guess, I don't know. Should I characterize attachment styles a little bit more?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, yeah, maybe, yeah, some traits or even okay. things that would be kind of subtle signs of each one.
Yeah. I think there are some basic characteristics that are generalizations, but I think are super helpful. So, anxious folks tend to have a negative view of the self and a positive view of mm-hmm. others, mm-hmm. right? They're putting people on pedestals, chasing after people, you know, other people's needs matter more than mine, yada, yada. Avoidance have the opposite, where they have a positive view of themselves and a negative view of others. Like, oh, this person is needy or clingy, they want too much for me or whatever. And like, I'm fine by myself. You know, I don't need this person up my butt right now. Disorganized has kind of negative view of self and others. Mm-hmm. And then secure is a positive view of self and a positive view of others. Mm-hmm. So there's these four permutations of your opinion of self and others, you know, that create these four different attachment styles. And then what isn't exactly a one-to-one correlation, but what you'll see often with these four different attachment styles is four different conflict styles. And I love this. And I would like to say that I discovered this. I wrote an article about it. I've never seen it anywhere else, but I'm going to go ahead and say it.
Okay. We'll give you the credit.
I'm planting my flag in this one.
Okay. Okay. Let's do it.
Anxious people tend to have a lose-win conflict resolution style, which means I'm going to take the L so you can be happy. Anxious people are like, you know, throw themselves under the bus. They're like, whatever. I don't, you know, sweep my wants and my needs under the rug, self-sacrifice, self-abandonment. I want you to be happy. I'll lose. You can win.
Fawning. It's kind of like fawning.
Yes, exactly. It's exactly what that is.
Which is kind of a weird word.
It is. I don't like it. Like fight, fawn, freeze, fawn. Flee. Those are great. And then
fawn.
I figure like,
what is that?
I see a baby deer in the woods.
Yeah, little Bambi. You know, like,
yeah. So anyway, that's the word we got. We needed an F word to complete the alliteration scheme there. Anyway, where was I?
So would be lose win or win lose.
Avoidance.
Yeah, sorry. Avoidant would be win lose. Uh huh.
Avoidant people have a win lose. Like, hey, it's going to be my way or highway, you know, or like screw you. They have a win lose attitude towards stuff. Going into arguments and conflict of it needs to be my way. Disorganized, they roll a hand grenade right into the thing. They're like, fuck everything. I'm taking everybody down. If I can't have it, nobody can, you know, like lose-lose, basically. It's a lose-lose yeah. situation. They burn it to the ground. And secure attachment.
Everyone's a winner.
You look for a win-win solution, which it's always possible to have a win-win solution for the most part, maybe 99% of the time, but no one's getting thrown under the bus. No one is getting shamed or blamed or any of this stuff. We're saying, hey, you have needs. I have needs. Let's talk about how we can both get these needs met in a way that feels safe and respectful for both of us. It's miraculous. Rather, people do this.
Everyone gets a trophy.
Where are you on your conflict style? Do you take the L or do you make other people wrong? Like, how do you do that? Where do you see yourself?
You know, it's so interesting. Well, today, I don't know. I feel like I'm pretty win-win now.
Nice.
I do. In the past, lose-win for sure, because I'm anxious. It's so interesting, this coming up and a conversation I was having with like a friend yesterday. You know, I don't have any room in my life today for people who are not able to talk shit out.
Yeah.
You know, good. Like I don't, I was just talking to a friend about that. I fuck up. We all do.
Yep.
But I need to have people in my life who are willing to have those difficult conversations. I want to know. I want to know if I've said something wrong or I've hurt someone's feelings. Like, I want to know. And I'm like totally open to having that conversation. I'm just not down to just like brush things under the rug and like not address them and act like things are fine. Like, I just don't have space for that. So, but I wanted to ask. So when I was talking to my friend, so she had this situation where she's anxious, her friend's avoidant. they had a situation where my friend who's anxious, she felt like the other person was being kind of cold and aloof when they were going through a hard time. And now the avoidant has kind of like turned the situation around to where like my friend's in the fault. We can talk about it with relationships, but like, let's talk about it from like a friendship perspective. Like how the hell do avoidance and anxious, like how do they have successful friendships? What do you do? Cause I think that this is the way it is, right? I feel like with anxious attachers, they want to have the fucking conversation right away. Right. And so I guess that I'm saying I'm secure, but like that is showing me that like my anxiousness coming through, like I want the resolution. Yeah. I guess what I will say, what has changed about me is that I won't force a conversation anymore. Mm-hmm. And if somebody is like not willing to have that conversation, I will allow that space and I'll walk away. But how do you handle that when one person wants to have the conversation, wants to hash it out, mm-hmm. the other person is completely incapable of having that conversation? How do you move forward?
Yeah. So the anxious avoidant pair is a tale as old as time. Well, I wouldn't call it a trap. I think it's natural. I think it's completely natural. It's peas and carrots. And what's good to understand about the kind of the, I don't know if you want to call it symbiotic nature of their relationship, but they have kind of inverse triggers, right? So so when the anxious person feels someone pulling away from them,
they get activated. They want to get closer.
And, you know, get connection, get love, reestablish, whatever. The avoidant person, when someone is moving close to them, gets triggered, gets the same feeling of overwhelm, the same activation and flooded feeling that when someone is pulling away from the anxious, when someone gets close to the avoidant, they get that same freak out. And so they run away. And so, you know, they have like, you know, reciprocal trauma responses. And so it's the perfect shit spiral, right? So having an anxious avoidant friendship, relationship, boss or employee, like any relationship anxious avoidant creates a very predictable and volatile dynamic. Now, if you understand kind of, you know, how each one of these people operate and what their needs are and what their feelings and what their triggers are, you can kind of navigate that gently. You know, and it takes some smooth communication, some nonviolent communication. And yeah. So for your friend, for this friendship, how do we make this friendship work? I think it comes down to boundaries of being like, hey, this is what feels good for me. This is what I need in a relationship that's meaningful. You know, I need someone to like, you know, not disappear for a month and not talk to me and then show up like it's all cool. Like that doesn't work for me. Or whatever your needs are around any relationship, right? This shows up in work relationships. Like you need to tell your boss, hey, this is what I need in order to do my job successfully and in order for me to like my job. Mm-hmm. If I don't have these things, I'm going to suck at my job and I'm going to hate it. And then you're going to have a terrible employee. So would you provide these things? You know, and it's a win-win, right? Because, you know, I feel better. I'm a better employee. Boom. Everyone wins. And so, yeah, we do this with our relationships. Hey, this is what I need in order for this relationship to feel safe and respectful, you know? And so if there's an avoidant who, you know, needs to pull away, you know, the anxious person can be like, hey, you know, sounds like you need some space. You needed some time to process or whatever. And I would really love to have this conversation with you. Maybe we'll go, you know, go have lunch or something or have a sit down or whatever it is. But it's important for me to have this conversation.
Absolutely. How does an anxious person, how does one distinguish between like, this is a valid and healthy need versus this is like an unhealthy need that I need like in order to feel like validation and reassurance?
Yes. No, that's great. Great question. Because to a severely anxious person who has done no recovery work,
like I need you to text me every 30 minutes. That's my need.
Yeah. I need that. And it feels that way. It literally feels that way for people who have unresolved trauma, right? It's a visceral compulsive thing that has all the feelings of what needs feel like. Cause when you don't do this, I feel like I'm dying. When you don't text me every 30 minutes, my body starts to shut down.
I literally think I'm pretty sure I'm dying.
Yeah. And that happens. That really happens. And so if you're someone who's either anxious, avoidant, whatever you are, you know, if you have problems in your life that are compulsive, reoccurring, you know, maybe bad habits or like what's wrong with me kind of problems, that's some shit you need to heal. That's some stuff you need to learn about. You need some therapy. You need some 12 step. You need something to take a look at it, find out what's driving your bus, because it's not healthy, secure attachment driving your bus. Mm-hmm. So that would be my number one recommendation, is find out, you know, what your wounds are, what your triggers are, what's all the stuff that that's making you crazy. Find out what your crazy is, you know, and find out how you can treat that, how you can heal that. And find out what healthy needs are, mm-hmm. right? Because the problem with growing up in a dysfunctional household is you think it's normal, because everyone, you know, like you're just born into this thing, mm-hmm. and you have nothing else to compare it to. So you're like, yeah, this is normal. Like it's Tuesday, dad's beating mommy, you know, or like the cops are here again, or like, you know, dad said we're low on Q-tips and disappeared for 3 days, you know, or like, you're like, this is fine. This
I
is
heard there's fine. A shortage.
Yeah, you know, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had to go to Mexico to go get some more. Whatever your normal is, people just accept that as like, yeah, this is fine. And so they have all the, I think most people have some type of either trauma or conditioning or maladaptive behaviors or something from their childhood that they don't even realize isn't healthy. Because we escape our childhood, we get out of there as fast as we can, and then we like get jobs and degrees and mortgages and shit, and we start acting real adulty and like, don't look at me, you know, like everything's fine over here, I mow my lawn or whatever, like we just pretend like we're adults.
Weed whacker.
And yeah, we weed whack whatever we gotta do, and we don't look at the past, even though that shit is driving all of our relationships.
Well, that's why I created this fucking podcast.
Exactly. You got to do some crime scene investigation. Go back in there. That's where all the juicy stuff is. People.
Okay, but on that though, everything I read is like your attachment style is developed like in the first 3 years of your life. Yeah. Like, I don't know what the fuck happened.
Yeah, well, that's also a thing. Who knows what happened? And whatever caused you to be an anxious attacher by the time you were 3 years old, your parents probably didn't switch the game up after your third birthday. They probably kept on doing that same bullshit for, you know, the rest of your life.
But what if something happened, like, I mean, around, I don't know, 6 or 7, I feel like that's when I became aware of things or things started. But is it possible that somebody could have like a healthy parents relationship, like up until age 6, and then things change and then you develop an anxious attachment? Or like, would that secure already be kind of like formed and solidified by then? Do you know about that? Like, can it change during childhood?
I don't know that there's a black and white yes no answer to that, but I feel like, from what I know, so like, look at the work of Dr. Bruce Perry, who's like super gangster developmental child psychologist, you know, worked with all of the worst traumatized cases of children in the world. Anyway, he talks about how trauma in the first 2 months of life has a far greater impact than trauma, you know, after that, you know, from 2 months to 18 years old. Like, just timing on trauma matters, and severity and recurrence. Like, there's a lot of things that that play as factors, but yeah, I think if you had a wonderful childhood until you were 6, and then your parents died and you got caught up in the foster care system and shit got weird, you'd have a 1,000,000% chance better of not, you know, shooting dope in the gutters and scrapping copper wiring, you know, from people's houses and ended up in prison. Right? Like, if when you have that secure experience, because that's our early childhood experiences, like I said, babies are human starter kits, and they're little sponges, and they absorb, they find out when they're born, right away, they start looking around and absorbing everything and saying, hey, is it safe around here? Can I trust people around here? Can I get my needs met around here? And they find out what kind of universe they're living in. And once they have that programmed in there, that's the operating system, mm-hmm. right? And babies, I'll try not to go way down the matrix rabbit hole right now, but babies operate on like delta brainwave, like when you're sleeping, like kind of super low frequency brainwave activity. And then as they grow, they move into a theta brainwave. So this delta, theta, alpha, these are all kind of subconscious lower mind brainwave frequencies. And then we grow up and move into beta brainwave frequencies, which is like waking life, running around, you know, doing algebra, buying groceries, kind of just thinking brain stuff. But the early brainwave frequencies, that's all of our subconscious mind. Our subconscious mind is being programmed in our early years. Mm-hmm. And then we just operate on that. And then we're just, as adults, we're just running around on the beta frequency. And we're not even touching those other frequencies. They're just playing like an old dusty tape on loop, just playing. And so Bruce Lipton is this cat, this biologist who wrote a book called The Biology of Belief. He says, your life is a printout of your subconscious mind. Mm-hmm. I love that. And so we get this shit programmed in us when we're little babies, and it's just in there swirling around, and we're adults, and our thinking brains are like logical adult brains are like, why am I doing this? It doesn't make sense. I read these books. But your subconscious mind is just
printing out shit. Rolling. Print that just shit
printing
out.
Shit out. Bzz, bzz, bzz. Yeah. And we're like, you know, what's going on here? And so that's why hypnotherapy is awesome, right? Mm-hmm. You can walk people down into those subconscious states. That's like EMDR, and mm-hmm. there's different modalities to work not with people's thinking brain. That's the thinking yes. about healing. There's some cognitive work to do for sure. Crime scene investigation, learn about attachment theory, like do all this book learning. But there's your nervous system that's just fucking wired a certain way. You can't read a book that away. You know what I mean? You can't make it go away with information. You have to feel in your body feelings and experiences of being safe, seen, soothed, and secure, mm-hmm. and knowing that you're competent and getting your needs met, being able to take care of yourself and set boundaries. You need to feel that in your body, and then your physical organism goes, oh, the war is over. Oh, cool. We can function. We can be adults. We can mature now. I went on a sick rant. I want to pause there and leave some space for you to, I can keep going.
I have something. Yeah. So I have several things. Well, really quickly, let me ask you this. Do people ever have one attachment style in romantic relationships and a different one in friendships?
So people with disorganized attachment definitely flip flop, you know, and keep people in different boxes, you know, and can even show up in a romantic relationship anxious, and then the next time avoidant. So that definitely happens with people that are on the disorganized side of things.
I had someone ask this question. They said, in retrospect, I feel like I'm anxiously attached until I'm in a relationship, and then I switch to avoidance somehow. And I'm like, she said, is that an AC specific or am I just nuts? And I said, no, it sounds like you're disorganized.
Yeah. Yeah. That could be a thing that she's disorganized. It also depends on the partner, right? Because it's a spectrum, right? I mean, these things are kind of labels. I'm anxious. I'm avoidant. It's a whole spectrum, right? It's not really, you know, just this kind of binary thing. But so when your partner is further to the right or further to the left of you, that's going to determine, you know, what kind of person you are. Even if someone is a securely attached person, and let's say I'm flaming anxious, mm-hmm. and I show up, you know, with all this anxiety shit and protest behaviors and mm-hmm. you know, writing love songs for them and whatever goes on, and they hit me with the whoa, you know, a secure person might start looking a little avoidant to someone who's super anxious, because they got to put up some strong boundaries, because the anxious person is not afraid of barbed wire fences. The anxious person will throw a grappling hook over that thing, you know, like. So yeah, we can kind of bring different attachment patterns out of
other people,
partners, depending on. Yeah.
No, we manifest it into our reality. It sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's the thing that I like to share with people. So I'm type 1 diabetic. I shared that. Yeah. If I don't take insulin, I'll be dead within 48 hours, right? And if I like kind of don't really take care of myself, kind of sorta, and I'm eating cake and not exercising and just, you know, whatever, it'll shut down my liver. They'll amputate some feet and things, and like it'll destroy me. My life will suck. I'll go blind, whatever. But if I take care of my condition, I live a beautiful, long, healthy, wonderful life. Like I'm 37 in the best shape of my life. My life is fantastic. I've been diabetic 30 years. I take care of it. Everything is lovely. I go where I want to go. I do where I want, what I want to do. Like it's all good. Attachment style is kind of like this. If you don't know what your attachment style is and you don't know how to take care of it, it can destroy your life. it could burn down your relationships, make your life really suck. You know, they might have to amputate a foot. But if you know your attachment style and you're like, oh, I know that I'm just predominantly anxious. That's like my go-to. I'm anxious. And I know what that looks like. I know what it means. I know the signs. I know what I need to do to take care of my condition. Because mm-hmm. my anxious attachment isn't your problem. It's not my partner's problem. And a lot of people really want it to be their partner's problem. It's not. It's your shit and you need to take personal responsibility for it. And when you do, it's lovely. And your partner's like, oh, cool, let's be together. Because you're not this liability where I have to, you know, feel responsible for your outrageous feelings all the time. You know, no one wants to be around that shit. So find out what your deal is, what your ACA, your codependency, your, you know, whatever is driving your bus, whatever shame you have, whatever anxious avoidance stuff, find out what it is and figure out, hey, how do I live with this? How do I manage this condition? And when you do, it's fine.
Do you feel like at the root of any insecure attachment is complex trauma?
Yeah, I think that's what we would call that, complex trauma, because PTSD, you know, could be like I was in a car accident you know, just an event, and complex trauma is more recurring things. And that's a lot of times what childhood dysfunction is complex trauma. It's this developmental relational trauma. Yeah, absolutely.
So I guess my question is, do you feel like if somebody is not secure, if they have another attachment style, is that an indication that there is some sort of unresolved trauma?
I say yes. I agree. I put all my money on yes. If you Google anything hard enough, you'll find somebody to say no, but I truly believe that. All my clients I work with that I'm coaching, people that got insecure attachment styles, 100% of them would go back in their childhood and they were beat, they were abandoned. Even like, you know, they were diagnosed with a weird disease when they were two, and then they were in the hospital for a month and they didn't see their parents. Like there's some kind of thing happened with every one of these people. The only exception being people who say, I don't remember my childhood, which means some shit went down.
Yeah, clearly.
So we don't need to know what happened. That shit was traumatic. I am positive.
I'm 1000%.
Yes. Sold.
Yeah. So when it comes to this stuff, first, I think that there's work that we have to do, right? Alone, single. And then once we get to a certain place, then there's the next level of work, right? Like that has to be done trying to have a relationship, right? I think it's unrealistic to think that, and I wish it could be this way. I wish it could be like, okay, I'm going to be single for a while. I'm going to work on all my shit. And then when I start dating again, it is just going to be easy breezy, you know,
lovely,
like a slice of pie, no challenges. But that's unrealistic.
That doesn't happen.
No,
that's not real. This is how we learn. Like we learn through experience, right? Like, I don't know if Einstein, it might've been Einstein, who said experience isn't the best teacher, it's the only teacher.
Fuck Einstein.
Right, so fuck that guy. But you can read all these books, you can do all the therapy, you know, talk about it in your 12-step groups, whatever. But you have to live it, you have to do it, you have to make it your own, you have to feel it in your bones, you have to experience it, and you got to hear those words come out of your own mouth when you set a boundary or when you do the right thing. Like, you need that experience to rewire your nervous system. Gabor Mate says that, it was in an interview or something, you probably won't find it if you look at his literature, but I heard him say that trauma teaches us to fear our feelings instead of feel our feelings. When you begin to actually feel your feelings and allow yourself to feel them, and you can sit with them, you can tolerate your own feelings without needing to self-medicate or escape or you know, whatever you do with it instead of feeling it. When you build this capacity for being human, for making mistakes, for having feelings and sitting with it and saying, okay, where do we go from here? That's when you know you're healing. Mm. Instead of just running away from the experience or just saddling your trauma response and riding off into the sunset, you know, like just sitting still and going, okay, what's going on right now? What's happening? Mm. Because that means you've built enough safety in your life for that to be possible. Because if I don't feel safe, I'm doing lizard brain shit all day. Mm. You can't stop me. I need to build safety in my life, in my relationships, in my job, in my home, like my finances. Like I need to feel safe. Mm-hmm. And when I feel safe, then I can heal. Mm. You can't heal from inside the burning building. You have to create a safe life for yourself. Mm. And once you have healthy, adult, mature connections, you got people you can rely on, you have tools and resources, you have this like secure base to stand on, then you can do some really awesome healing work and you can start seeing the growth that you're seeing in yourself.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
In your episode with on avoidant attachment, which I would like to talk a little bit more about, because I feel like on this podcast, we've mostly talked about like anxious attachment style and not as much as avoidant. But for so sure. There was four signs that you gave. The one thing that you were talking about was boundaries, which I thought was so interesting, and how the difference, how both anxious and avoidant struggle with setting boundaries, but how they look different.
Yeah. So definitely with anxious attachment, you are afraid to set boundaries because you're afraid that like you're going to be left, you're going to be abandoned if you stand up for yourself, right? Like that's basically at the core of it. And then with avoidant attachment, you are afraid to set boundaries because you feel like your partner is going to have a big reaction to it. And you also just don't know how to set boundaries. And you're kind of just afraid that you're going to mess it up. And it's just easier for you if you just pull away from the partner than trying to like show up and have the conversation. Because basically with avoidant attachment, you believe you're really bad at relationships. So that kind of communication, you're just going to avoid at all costs. It's fascinating, isn't it? Yeah. So growth edge for avoidantly attached folks is learning I can set boundaries. I can learn how to do it well. And my partner can respect them. So I can learn to have my own space and have my relationship, and that boundaries are really, really important for me to be comfortable with, right? Because then I can be close to you. I can have a relationship with you, and I can hold on to my identity and have my own sense of independence as well. So yeah, that's why boundaries are a huge growth area for avoidantly attached folks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then can you talk about what some of the other signs were? One was related to career.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love this because it's so common where people just say, and we're seeing this more and more with women too. This used to be predominantly kind of like male way of thinking, but it's a lot of women as well, where you have a belief and you say, I'm just focused on my career right now. I don't have time for a relationship. And the underlying belief is that I can't have both, or that a relationship's going to negatively impact my career. And essentially the truth, right, is that actually you're afraid of being in a relationship because there's messy things there and there's things you don't understand. And your career is much more your comfort zone. You know, in your career, I work harder, I get a better result. And you don't get that same equation in relationships. So you would much rather devote your time to your career. It's not that you don't have time for relationships. You just don't feel like you're good at them. So you'd rather put your time in your career. Mm-hmm. I hope I didn't make anyone cry with that tough love, but that's the truth.
I wanted to talk about how attachment style affects other things than just romantic relationships. What are some areas that people, I mean, obviously I know it shows up in all relationships, but what would be something surprising or something that people might not know is actually related to their insecure attachment style?
I have two that come to mind. Money and career. Yeah. So with money, if I'm anxiously attached to my money, I'm always worried that there's never going to be enough, that it's going to all go away at one moment. I have that belief of like, oh my gosh, if I get it, like I should probably spend it now because I don't know how long I'm going to have it. Mm-hmm. And if I'm avoidantly attached with money, I probably am just like, I don't even want to deal with this. And maybe I'm just kind of like saving my money. And I'm really believing that, it's just all going to work out. And I'm not even going to look at it. Like, I might not even know like what my bank account numbers are. Mm-hmm. I'm just not really engaged in my relationship with money, which has its own problems. Right. And, and then I could just be spending and not knowing it. So that's an interesting one, like your relationship with money and finances. And then work. If you think about work, like if you are securely attached to your job and you believe in your job and you love it and you love being close to the people you work with and you enjoy your career, you're so much more willing to take risks, right? Like secure attachment allows us to take risks and step into our highest and best selves. If I'm anxiously attached to my job, I'm like worried that, you know, I'm going to get fired at any moment. I'm just going to stay small. I'm going to do my bare minimum, just try to get by. Right. And I'm so scared it could end at any moment. So I'm not really willing to take risks or speak up. I'm just kind of like getting through it. I'm not setting boundaries. I'm not asking for what I need at work. It's a really, really painful way to be. And then avoidantly attached, this is the one who's like fly under the radar, right? Like just show up, clock in, clock out. And their belief is like, I don't really care about my job that much. It's just a paycheck. Like, you know, I'm just going to live for the weekends, whatever. And like not really ever really get close to your coworkers or even really enjoy your work and just kind of have it be part of your life. So yeah, I love thinking about attachment styles in other aspects, because yeah, they're everywhere for sure.
What about, is there any like research on or correlations between attachment styles and like substance abuse and addiction?
Yeah, what I know about the research that's coming to mind for me is just emotional unavailability and substance use. Obviously when we're emotionally unavailable for a relationship, then we're going to be, I mean, if we're using substances, we're emotionally unavailable for a relationship. Mm-hmm. That's what I meant to say. So it's like when you experience addiction, you're already in a relationship and it can be a very unhealthy relationship with whatever substance you have. And that just makes you emotionally unavailable for any kind of romantic relationship. So like some of the clients that I talk to, I know like they have been married for 20 years to an alcoholic and they're getting out of the relationship and they realize that their husband was avoidantly attached the entire time and emotionally unavailable. And the fact is, because he had a relationship with alcohol, like he already had a relationship, so he couldn't be in a relationship with you. So that's kind of where my brain goes. So I know about emotional unavailability and an alcohol use. But as far as research on attachment styles and substance, I haven't looked at anything. I don't know if there's anything out there. Could be a good study.
Has there been any like recent, like big studies like that have come out related to attachment?
Oh yeah. There's always attachment theory research out there.
Something that you find particularly fascinating?
One of my latest ones that I was really enjoying was research on ADHD and attachment. Yeah. So a high correlation with a insecure attachment style, whether it's anxious or avoidant, and a learning disorder, attention deficit. And it makes total sense because for both, whether it's attention deficit or an insecure attachment style, both of those, you had a parent that was not good at attunement, that was not as engaged. So I just think that one, once you hear it, you're like, oh yeah, it makes sense. But I think that's great that they've kind of connected those things. And then it's like, oh my gosh, these poor people with attention deficit also have dysregulated attachment systems. So anyone who has attention deficit, I think, should also be screened for a dysregulated attachment system, because it's highly likely that you experience that as well, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to disorganized attachment, because so many people listening right now, I think, have disorganized. When you talk about anxious, generally speaking, what people say is, okay, there was like a lack of like connection, like in childhood. And then avoidant is like, there's a lack of safety. And then I guess disorganized would be both. Is that how you would explain it?
Yes. I also like that definition. I also think that with disorganized attachment, it's someone who has had all these different strategies available to them. So they haven't had a consistent enough experience to develop strategies that are consistent. With disorganized attachment, essentially you didn't have stability. You likely had relational trauma growing up. You might've had big T trauma growing up, right? And what happens is, you have tried all kinds of strategies to try to get your needs for connection met. So your brain has both avoidant attachment strategies and anxious attachment strategies. Just because of the trauma, you got more creative and you have more strategies available. So with disorganized attachment, it's that horrible feeling and confusion of like, I don't even know how I'm going to respond in any given scenario, because my brain does have all these different strategies for connection. Does that clarify my point?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So is there a way that you could take a situation and like illustrate how a disorganized person would react to it or show up, like versus anxious and avoidant? Or is it just that like, sometimes they kind of show up as anxious and sometimes they show up as avoidant?
I'm so glad you asked this. So, because there's so many people, and a lot of people talk about attachment styles and they don't actually have all the knowledge and the research. So I feel like this gets missed a lot. So I'm so glad you're asking. So disorganized attachment is different than just having anxious or avoidant or having both. You can have both anxious and avoidant strategies and not be disorganized. Okay. So in order to meet criteria for a disorganized attachment style, there has to be a pendulum swing between anxious and avoidant behaviors where you are going between the two fairly quickly.
Okay.
So, and I could do an example on this, like classic, let's say you went on a great date. You're not hearing from the person. anxious attachment, you're like sending the 17 text messages, you're really worked up, you really want to see this person, you're kind of freaking out, right? And then if I have disorganized attachment, I could have that response. And then let's say the next morning or even maybe later that night, I book a flight to Cabo with my girlfriends and I'm like, F that dude, I'm out of here. So 1 minute I'm anxious, anxious, anxious. And then I pendulum swing to avoidant. So it's that I get close to you and then I go, woof, all the way away. And this is sometimes also known as splitting, which I'm sure you've heard of splitting. It can get confused for that, where people are like all good. They're on the pedestal, or they're the lowest of the low and you want nothing to do with them. So you're kind of like switching back and forth. But yeah, that's in more extreme cases where we probably see a borderline personality disorder and diagnosis as well. Just in like a regular disorganized attachment, you would have that I move forward, I move back, and it pendulum swings quickly. I hope that made sense.
Is there any other misconceptions about disorganized attachment that you think people have?
I think that a lot of people may not realize that they have it. And I think sometimes people think that they're all anxious attachment when they in fact do have disorganized attachment style, and they probably just don't know what to look for. So there's that. And then, yeah, I think this fact of like, I know I mentioned, I'm getting so excited. I don't get to nerd out on this stuff very much. I feel like we're going so deep. I'm like, okay, breathe. This is fun to talk about. With borderline personality disorder, right? People hear that label and they think that that's like who you're going to be for the rest of your life. And it's a person.
So people see that and like, they probably don't have that. And they probably just have complex trauma.
See, that's what I wanted to get to, is like, sometimes people with the label of that, they actually just have a disorganized attachment style that's wrecking their relationships. So I would really encourage people to understand attachment theory before giving a BPD diagnosis.
I do think that this is important to address. Like, people seem to think, because I've had people on that are like, you're screwed if you got disorganized, and that's not true.
No. Yeah. I mean, I'm an example of that, I definitely met criteria for disorganized attachment and have moved towards secure. It certainly took me time and work, but it's absolutely possible.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say?
I think a large part of that is addressing the trauma component.
Yeah, I believe in, and this is, I have a program, as you know, and the program is really built on being able to release your past. So trauma, understand your past, really deep belief work, beliefs about yourself, beliefs about relationships, being able to rewire your brain. And learning how do you show up as a securely attached person, and how can you create that securely attached identity for yourself, and learning how to show up that way. So, that's what I get to teach people to do. It's so rewarding for me because it's life changing.
So are you're more avoidant?
I was avoidant, and I've grown to be more secure, but in the past, I wasn't able to tolerate, let's say, going on a long date.
Okay.
Like, if I was going on a date, it had to be like an hour and a half tops.
If it was somebody that like you've been with for a while, or just is like in the initial stages?
In the initial stages. But if it was someone that I've been with for a while, I wouldn't be able to spend a weekend with that person. Maybe Friday night, a little bit of Saturday. But Sunday, whether I had plans or not, I had plans. I was out. Mm-hmm. I was not able to tolerate, just on a physiological level, the being close with people for an extended period of time. And
what about girlfriends? Like, could you do that with friends? Like, could you spend a weekend with friends, or was it, or that too?
Yeah, non-romantic relationship. Yeah, that was easy. So I was really fortunate to always have had really great girlfriends and generally have, you know, had amazing friends and be able to spend time with people. Although I will say that to this day, I frequently think, you know, not with all my girlfriends, but with friends that are like, they're very close with, that know me really well. Like I catch myself having this thought, like, are they tired of me?
Mm.
You know? Mm-hmm. Like I catch myself having this thought, like, oh, this person must be really, really tired of me. And it does sometimes influence my behavior, even, you know, get like really quiet or whatever, and like just be like, I need, you know. So I do experience that, but it was definitely easier with girlfriends and with friends over romantic relationships. Those were tough. And I think I always, because I had a pretty positive relationship with my mom and with my sister, I had very positive relationships with women and very difficult relationships with men.
Mm. So were you typically attracted to more anxious attachers?
I was, no. Interestingly enough, I know they say this very frequently, is that, you know, mm-hmm. avoidance don't end up being together. But for me, I was mostly attracted to avoidance. And, you know, those relationships would last for years, but we would only see each other maybe like once a month. So,
wow.
And you know, it was suitable for both. And I had, you know, I appreciate the people that did come into my life and did teach me lessons. And yeah.
So do you think it just being somebody who's like an anxious attack, like the thought of being avoidant, it just boggles my mind. And it also just sounds like, honestly, I know they both suck, but like, I just think that being anxious is a lot more painful.
You know, I don't know, because I haven't been on the anxious side very much, but the literature says, at least, you know, I don't know from personal experience, but the literature says that avoidant people actually experience significantly more pain, but they show it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That, well, there was actually a study where they, it was a skin conductivity test. So they like measure how much stuff there's going on, like how much people are reacting and sweating, and also measuring heart rate. And they found that with people who are avoidant, their heart rate pulse was significantly higher.
Oh, I think I heard this.
Yeah. Over the anxious attachers, because I think you anxious attachers, you at least give yourself the opportunity. You give yourself the permission to, you know, maybe message someone an extra amount of times, or like talk about your problem.
It doesn't feel like permission.
Yeah, like a compulsion, right?
Yes.
But I think perhaps with, you know, with people who are anxiously attached, you attract people who support you. Like it's more likely. Like when I was in my avoidance stage, if I had any problems, I never talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
Who's more anxiously attached would, you know, start talking about it and talking really, really fast. And I love anxious attachers, you know, many of my friends are. And so I support them. by supporting them, I also support myself, really. But there's more of a, it's basically more of an opportunity for help, you know, when you're, mm-hmm. when you're for it. And so I actually, yeah. I mean, it's hard to say which one is more.
No, I know it. Yeah. It's different. It's it just is a miserable experience to be sitting there waiting for somebody to text you back. Can we unpack this some? Like, what have you, because is it a fear of engulfment that really lies at the root of it for you? Like, what are some of the limiting beliefs that you've unpacked about yourself that really lay at the core of your avoidant attachment?
Yeah. So early, you know, I think earlier in my life, it was a feeling of not being good enough. And it was a mm-hmm. feeling of, and it was a feeling of not wanting to disclose. So, you know, as I mentioned, like seeing someone once a week was perfect because there was not much of an opportunity for me to talk about myself. And I would ask people about them and learn about them. It was also really cautious. So I would want to make sure, you know, that I know and understand everything about this, you know, particular individual. And I just did not, you know, when it would come for me to talk about me or talk about my experience, I would shut down. And in that shutting, also want distance, because, you know, I wasn't able to talk about these things even to a therapist that I paid. So imagine being like on a date or, you know, being close with someone A lot of it had to do with just shame and just not feeling good enough and just feeling like, oh God, you know, I even remember telling my friends, like, when I was like 21 or 22, I would say, I'm never going to get married because, you know, I'm going to meet someone who's, you know, wonderful and from a wonderful family. And I always had very high standards, by the way. So, you know, I'm going to meet somebody who's wonderful and from a wonderful family and da-da-da. And it's going to come a time where I'm going to meet their family and it's going to be all great. But then there's going to be a time where they're going to have to meet my family. And I would not be able to withstand that. Therefore, you know, I decided that I'm just not even going to, you know, I had such a fear around that I'm not even going to enter into a serious relationship because there's going to be a time where, you know, this is going to happen. And so early on, it was about that. And then once I worked on those issues and was able to share my experience and be able to own it, it became more about, you know, it was just a physiological, you know, at some point I would feel like I'm literally being fried on a frying pan. Like, it's like my whole sizzling and I didn't know why. And I wanted relief from the anxiety. And that is how the psyche works, is that it's so difficult for us to experience anxiety that we want relief from it at any cost to go back to. And in my case, my safety is being by myself, because when I was growing up in my home, I was able to find activities where I can entertain myself, spend time by myself, read books, do fun things. And so for me, that was super, super comfortable.
Were you a lost child?
I was more of a lost child. I was a kind of a scapegoat / lost child. Yeah. Okay. / lost child. And so it was, you know, it was really easy for me to just retreat. And that felt safe rather than being with someone, especially for an extended period of time, would just give me such an immense, just physiological anxiety. And at that point, I also learned to tap into my body and tap into my sensations without placing judgments on it. So the ability to just feel and experience what you're experiencing by naming emotions and naming, like, wow, like I just feel, yeah, like a sardine on a frying pan or something. And not, you know, blame the situation or the person or decide that this person is not right for me as I did in the past. And so then being able to like tune into my physiological experience, tune in what I'm feeling and just sitting with it, you know, just like as much as I can tolerate, right? Like, wow, like I feel this way. How much can I tolerate it? And eventually that feeling reduced as well. And I still feel it. I still feel like that sometimes. And
what is
I
it get- when you talk about how much you can tolerate, when we talk about like window of tolerance, like how do you determine that for yourself? Like, how do you know what you can tolerate and when it's going too far and you need to, you know, back off?
Yeah, well, for me, I'm not nice to myself, so. But once I learned to tap into my emotions and to my feelings, I just sat there. But what I recommend to people is just to rate, you know, if it's like above a 7 or above an 8 or something, just take time out, you know, practice coping skills or find a distraction, call a friend, see a movie, pet a dog, go out for a walk. You know, get a good meal, whatever it is, breathe, you know, like don't just like sit there and torture yourself. But see how much you can experience and how much you can name and, you know, and also just see what happens. Sometimes these things evaporate, sooner than you would think, you know, when we're like pushing those feelings away, pushing that anxiety away. We're creating resistance, and those feelings actually persist. So how much can you experience and just see what happens?
When did you learn that what you had experienced was trauma?
Probably when I was in grad school already. I remember sitting in one of the classes and just being so dysregulated because something had happened in my relationship. And I was, and it wasn't anything like, you know, entirely, you know,
significant.
It wasn't that significant. It was pretty bad, but it wasn't that significant. But I just, you know, wasn't able to focus at all. And I just remember having this.
What an ACA thing. It was really bad, but it wasn't that significant.
Well, it wasn't like a breakup. It wasn't like, you know, I don't know, someone abused me, someone cheated on me. It was like a misunderstanding or whatnot. But yeah, I guess it is also an ACA thing to say.
Minimize.
Yeah. So just like listening to my body and just realizing, you know, this kind of fight or flight response time. And then actually, several years later, even when I did an EEG reading of my brain, you can actually see the fight or flight response in the, you know, different areas of the brain that were kind of. And when the woman, the practitioner, she looked at my brain, she said, "Oh, did you have childhood trauma?" That was just by looking at how reacting, and it's like, wow. That being said, any psychic ability, you know, reading brain waves is I guess it was later on. It wasn't when I had my panic attacks or anything though.
So one of the things that I watched your videos about it, but then I've also in your book read, you talk about kind of the five dysfunctional relationship patterns that adult children find themselves in. Which one do you relate to the most for you personally? So I'm looking at the book now. So we have, "It's all my fault, please don't abandon me," "Loving unavailable people," I would assume that you probably, that applies to you, "I will give, you will take," "Mind reading, fantasy pattern," or "Finding fixer uppers."
I was definitely the mind reading fantasy pattern camp for sure. I had my ideas about how things should be in relationships, and I was vigilant and wanted to make sure that unless things were such and such, you know, this is not the person for me. And I was extremely critical of others. And of course, all of this was just a way for me to stave off my anxiety from discovering the reality and the truth of this other person, including, you know, their own traumas, right? Their own thoughts, their feelings, their vulnerabilities. So I wasn't able to share mine, and I was not able to accept another person's as well. So because my dad, you know, was an alcoholic, I didn't have much of a pattern of finding, you know, alcoholics through playing the rescue role, actually, because I was so turned off by that. Besides when I was like an adolescence, maybe at the age of 19, I did have a partner who did struggle with the, drug abuse and alcoholism. And once again, that was actually also another kind of relationship after which I became even more avoidant. So experiencing that, I thought, you know,
I was going to ask you that actually, what were some of your initial relationship experiences, and if that influenced you into becoming more avoidant?
It did. This particular relationship certainly did, because I also did recognize, like, wow, you know, when I met this person, I didn't realize, you know, that he has all these problems. But then I found this person attractive and I started dating this person, and like, wow, he really reminds me of my dad in many ways, right? Mm-hmm. And so then I made a strong decision for myself to not engage with people who, you know, have these problems. And I didn't want to be a caretaker. I didn't want for that family dynamics to repeat in my life again. And so I was extremely hypervigilant, you know, about the people that I would meet. And then I had the mind reading, like, fantasy where everything was a red flag, you know, and everybody was like cut off if they didn't follow my ideas about, you know, what a relationship looks like, or what a partnership looks like, or what my, you know, ideal partner should be. And all of that was just like an unconscious way for me to remain single, of course.
That's so interesting, because when I would think of like fantasy pattern, like, you know, where I would go in my head and where it would be for me, it would be more along the lines of I decide who this person is, like in the first few dates, and I decide that I'm into them, right? And then it's the fantasy from there of like, okay, I don't need to collect any more data or information on this person. You know, a fantasy of what the relationship is, like in a much more like pleasurable fantasy route, right? Like I have a delusional idea of that this is like a healthy partner in a healthy relationship. And so then I get stuck in that fantasy pattern. The mind reading, I guess, would come in is like, the way I see that for me would be, you know, that we sense that somebody's pulling away, and then we act accordingly, and then in essence manifest it out of the other person. But I think it's really interesting what you're saying about the fantasy pattern of like being quite the opposite, right? Of like you having a fantasy of the ideal relationship and whatever partner or relationship you're in, that wouldn't match, like a lineup with the fantasy. And I've never really heard it that way. So could you explain some more?
Right. And I think it's so fascinating because I think it has to do with like that avoidant versus the anxious, because you still want to believe in the projection that you initiated onto that other person. And we all, by the way, like project onto each other, and that's normal. And we do.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. Yeah, the difference there. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Go ahead. Sorry.
And we idealize other people, and that's also part of the problem. And at some point, you know, what does it feel like to realize, wow, like I thought X of this person, and that's actually not the case. Like, what is the level of disappointment maybe that you experience, or do you feel like you trick yourself into not seeing that? Or yeah, what is that like? Because for me, you know, from the avoidance side, it's like, you know, if something doesn't go, you know, as planned, like let's say someone doesn't respond to me or whatever, right, for like a couple of days. In the past, I would be like, that person is not for me, right? And I like literally would never respond. I remember I met a man, and you know, we hit it off. He actually lived in a different city than me at the time. We hit it off. We spent like, I was visiting my girlfriend, so we spent like a couple of days together, not consecutively, but you know, like met up on a couple of occasions. And I was living in New York at the time, and he says, you know, why don't I come visit you to New York? And you know, I was excited, and I got tickets to see a Broadway show, and I invited some of my friends as well. And I told him in advance, because he was staying with a relative in New Jersey, and I said, you know, you need to leave like at X time, like at 6 o'clock or whatever, because, you know, there's traffic at this time, blah, 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 blah. We have to be at the show on time. And he ran late, like minutes late, you know? And in my mind, it was like, I told him and he didn't listen to me. And thus, you know, he disregarded what I said, you know, doesn't care. Also, I mean, the guy flew all the way to New York to basically see me, right? It's kind of a big deal. But I was like, well, you know, he came 15 minutes late to this show, and that's going to be. And I ignored his calls that evening, and I went to a show without him. You know, I didn't. It was bad. Like, and like, I was so convinced that I'm correct, right? That this was like, this was my mind reading. This was my fantasy. And also, you know, it's coupled with the belief that I'm not good enough. So it makes perfect sense that, you know, someone doesn't show up on time because I'm not really good enough to show up for anyways. And it was much easier for me to live by myself and not see anyone and feel that I'm not good enough than to, you know, allow myself to think, well, you know, things do happen. And okay, maybe he's, you know, maybe that person is not that timely even. And so that's a flaw maybe that this individual has. Maybe it's a little bit of ADHD going on. Maybe it's a little bit of this. Maybe it's a little bit of that, right? And granted, maybe this person was not right for me in the long run, right? But, and maybe there were, you know, there's a lot of things that could have been going on. But it was so like, you know, I was just so convinced. Versus maybe the other fantasy, which is oftentimes, I think people call it the fantasy bond, which is where you project something onto a person that the person is really not. And then you continue projecting that. And then at the times where you learn that this is not the case, there's like a discrepancy there, right? It feels like disappointing, right? Or it kind of puts you maybe into a little bit of a state of a panic, or, you know, in a rumination or whatever that might be. And then you either, and then it's almost like the projection screen comes on again, right? It's almost like, you know, maybe this was a one-time thing, right? It's almost like the projection screen comes on again. I don't know. What is it like for you?
It's so interesting. I've just never really thought about it this way. Like it is, it's like for me, it's like, I refuse to see anything bad. And then for the avoidant, it's like, they refuse to see anything good in a way. Right. It's like you project these, like I project positive qualities onto this person. And then I choose to disregard any further information that I collect that shows the opposite. Whereas for you, it's like you might have an image of who this person is that's in a negative light, and you refuse to take in any information that could prove otherwise. It's really fascinating. Holding on to, just let it all go. What's making you slow now? Just let it all go. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.